Three, two, one.
Here we go. Hey, hey, hey. Welcome, everyone, to episode 158 of the No Normal Show, brought to you by Revive. This is where we leave all things status quo, traditional, old school, and boring in the dust and celebrate the new, the powerful, the innovative, the future, all related to how brands can lead the way in health. I'm your co-host, Chris Bevelo, Chief Growth and Brand Officer at Revive. I am joined, as always, by co-host Stephanie Weirwell, who is SVP of Integrated Marketing at Revive. Hello, Stephanie.
Hello, Chris. Good to be with you. IRL.
IRL.
In real life.
This is a real story. We are. We're all in the same room. This is the first time that's happened, I believe. Yes? Okay. So across from me sits co-host Des Duncan, who's Vice President of Health, Equity, and Inclusion at Revive. Hello, Des.
Good morrow, Chris.
It's great to see you in person, IRL. We also have with us, as always, our show's producer and brand and growth coordinator at Revive, Luke McCandless. Luke, hello.
Hello, Chris.
Thank you for joining. And that's our introductions. What's next? Cons.
Oh, no.
Nope.
Can Lions.
Can Lions.
They're happening. It's happening.
So tell us, Stephanie, all about Can Lions.
Yeah, it is, by probably most people's standard, the premier, most important advertising and marketing awards show, festival that happens typically every year, but hasn't happened for the last couple of years because, of course, COVID. So it's happening for the first time, IRL. On the beaches of Cannes in France. And whenever I open my Instagram feed, I have massive FOMO because I feel like everyone I know is at Spotify Beach, just living their best lives.
Wait, where are they at?
Spotify Beach.
That doesn't sound French.
No, it's Spotify is paying a lot of money to be a sponsor and host part host.
Of an entire beach?
I think so.
Wow.
That sounds horrible.
They're just calling.
Nobody wants to go to Spotify Beach.
I do.
Okay, continue.
I would totally go to
okay.
Spotify Beach.
Anyway, so the important part, so Cannes Lions is not just an awards show, but it's also kind of a conference series festival where people gather and share, what's new and what's next in the space of marketing, advertising, all things creative. So what's really interesting, I think, and relevant to our space, which is health brands and healthcare, is this year there were two, so far, there have been two big, big winners in the health space. One was Dell, who won a really, really interesting award for some work that they did for a treatment, I guess, if you will, of a
is it the recording of the voice?
Yes.
MSD?
It's called, see, part of the problem with being IRL is you can't have your notes as you usually do. Anyway, they created a voice bank for a motor neuron disease where they actually, instead of just doing advertising, they created kind of like a book, a voice bank, where people with this motor neuron disease could bank their voice so that as they lose their voice over time, their friends, family, kids could still experience it. So that's one example. We can talk more about it. But the other example that I think is really relevant is a team out of India who created a mosquito coil to actually solve the problem of malaria. And it's something that you put in the trash and not just in your home, because that's where mosquitoes are a problem. Oh. So one of the takeaways here that
can you wear the mosquito coil?
I don't think so.
In Minnesota, you would need to wear it.
There
directly.
You go.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just clarifying.
So what's interesting about this, and Fierce Healthcare or Fierce Pharma did some coverage of this, is if you rewound 5 years ago at Cannes, health was not talked about. Healthcare was not center stage. And I think we've seen this at a lot of the big conferences where, given COVID, health has been more center stage. But more importantly, both of these awards kind of showcase that it's not about, creative in the way it used to be anymore. It's not our TV spots and our ads. It's people solving real problems. And it's like multidisciplinary teams coming together to say, how do we solve a health issue and not just put out communication about it?
I love that. It's right up my alley. It's like, as I say all the time, like, I'm tired of hearing stats. Like, what are we actually doing? So that's exciting to see that there is more momentum behind that.
Don't stats come from doing?
Stats
some
come,
stats?
Some stats. But a lot of stats come from researching and understanding, but not necessarily addressing the issue that they're arising with said stats.
Got it. We want doing stats, not understanding stats. Understanding stats are okay, but if they stop with understanding, what's the point?
It's a good start, but yes, it does not get you over the finish line.
I like that. That's good. Impact. We used the word impact a lot yesterday.
Right.
Sounds like impact. We need to measure impact, not intent or understanding.
Yes. CAN has often gotten the bad reputation, just like many award shows, of, oh, it's this cool idea, it's just so creative, instead of, does it make an impact? So I like the direction here.
Yeah. Awesome. All right. So we're gonna veer wildly from that topic, which was creative and fun and interesting. This is interesting. I'll go backwards. Kind of fun, not creative, this topic. So what we're going to talk about today is the idea of code switching. And this really came from last week's episode, where we talked more about the rise of health sex and the politicalization of healthcare, and how we focus on a lot of things that are happening today, but we explored some things that are happening in the future. And in doing so, we kind of stumbled across, we tripped over what amounts to code switching. And I'm going to give an example to kind of connect through politicalization of healthcare to code switching. I'm going to have Des kind of set up code switching. And this is an article that came from the Washington Post a week or so ago. The headline is "Tension Over Role of Racism in Public Health Strains Virginia Agency Under Youngkin." So Youngkin's the new governor there. He's inserted a gentleman. Did we talk about this last week? I don't think so.
We touched on it a little bit.
Okay, I'm going to go a little deeper. So he inserted a new chief public health official, Colin Green is his name, who has rejected the state-recognized declaration that racism is a public health crisis and downplayed the role of racism in health disparities, leaving some fearful for their jobs, blah, blah, blah. But what he does is he goes in to talk about how, A, he doesn't believe racism is connected to health disparities, which I can't even wrap my head around. And then he gets into this area that I think we did touch on a little bit, about the politically charged words that he wants to avoid because they might alienate certain people. In his case, he's very fearful of alienating white people. And so, for example, he says, if you say racism, you're blaming white people. That sounds like not a real thing. This sounds like an Onion article, but that's what he says. Enough the world thinks that what you're saying, that you've lost a big piece of your audience. Then he goes on to say, we mentioned this last time, it's not just the word racism. For example, when people use the term gun violence, I have a problem with that. Gun violence is frankly a Democratic talking point. When you use that term, every Republican in the room is going to walk out. So our point last week was like, see how things like gun violence is instantly politicized and how that relates to healthcare. But this also then transitions into the idea of code switching, of how we have to be thoughtful about the words we use, some of us more than others, to be able to assimilate or feel safe or feel like they're going to be listened to. So that's my introduction. Des, give us your take on code switching.
Yeah, I mean, you touched on it. It's at its core, it's essentially about like safety as well as comfort. So the language that you use to make the other folks in the room feel comfortable, or the language or the mannerisms or the colloquialisms you use to make another person that might be a minority in the room that you see one another, like, hey, I'm here too, safety in numbers. And, you know, within the Black community, especially growing up, you know, that comes in the form of code switching, which is essentially the practice of shifting the languages you use or the way that you express yourself in your conversations to make others feel comfortable. This could be changing of mannerisms, tone of voice, linguistic code switching between standard English and a more relaxed vernacular. And essentially, this is something that we all do in some form. You know, depending on who we're talking to, we might change up the way, you know, we're speaking from, you know, your family to friends to coworkers to authority figures. Like you kind of change, you try to match the room or meet people where they are in that way. However, it is definitely more prevalent in communities who aren't a part of the mainstream dominant culture. So we've seen this play out in various ways. And in fact, there was a movie a couple of years ago starring Lakeith Stanfield called Sorry to Bother You, which was exactly—
Great movie.
Yeah.
Have you guys all seen that? So good. Stephanie?
I have not. No, homework.
Homework. Yeah, so the film is about this young black man in Oakland who is, you know, just kind of getting by, doing his thing, as you are when you're like 24. And he has to, in order to succeed in sales and in business, he has to put on his quote unquote white voice. And so the whole movie then goes into how he's like switching back and forth and how he's able to get further ahead in life and in career because he's switched up to meet and sound like the dominant culture. I was really blown away by this movie because I was like, wow, look at my existence on the big screen right now. But there has been this shift in, especially in recent years, where people are like, you know, honestly, I'm tired of having a code switch. Like, why can't I just show up as my authentic self in the office, at home, like wherever? You know, how do I do that, but also protect myself, my future, my safety? Because again, like I said, this shows up in other ways. There's a story of a young 26-year-old trans woman who there's like LGBTQ plus code switching in the sense that she notices that her speech and mannerisms change depending on how comfortable she feels around a customer. When she gets customers that she knows or assumes are queer, she gets a lot more vocal fry. She laughs, she swears a bit. But in contrast, she turtles up when she is in a dealing with a customer that she might, you know, deem as maybe threatening. You know, her voice drops in tone and pitch. Her sentences get shorter. And she makes less eye contact and is not as expressive because you're just trying to like essentially make yourself small. Like, so I've definitely done that in a more positive way. Like I mentioned before, like when you're in a room and you see someone, you're like, oh, I think we're people, we're family. Like you try to make it known that, hey, we're a part of the same tribe. So given that, have you either of you experienced or done code switching yourselves?
I have a question first.
Yeah.
So how much of, well, I have a question and then a theory, and you tell me if my theory is right or wrong. How, question is, how much of this, how much of code switching is sort of subconscious versus strategic and really thought through? My theory is that for dominant cultures, it's probably more subconscious because they're not having to make as far of a jump. I would imagine that otherwise maybe it has to be a lot, like put a lot more effort put into it.
Yeah, honestly, I don't even know. It just comes so naturally at times that it's like, wow, I didn't even realize I did it. The first time I realized this was in college, and I was hanging out with a friend of mine. We were at the coffee shop, and we were just like cutting up, whatever. And someone that I knew from work, like I worked mostly with the public. I was with television, so you know, engaged with a lot of folks like outside of just my own like university world. And she came up to say something to me, and apparently my voice changed. And I did notice at the time when she left, he was like, okay, corporate voice, like who was that person? I'm like, oh my gosh, I didn't realize that that's something that I do. That was the first time that I realized like I code switch depending on who the audience, who I'm talking to. So in a way, because you are a part or not a part of a dominant culture, it just becomes the way you do life, navigate life. Whereas maybe if it's not, you think about it a little bit more. And it's not so much that it's a stretch, because if you are a part of the dominant culture, you don't have to really understand the others as much,
right?
Versus if you were growing up as, you know, the minority culture, then you have to understand your own as well as be able to navigate the dominant one. And because you're, you know, all kind of lumped into these other minority groups where you all share space together and commiserate, you understand their culture as well. And some would say, you know, there's actually strength in that, that like we can navigate more spaces easily than those that are a part of the dominant mainstream culture.
So let's go back. So I didn't answer the question. So Chris, have you ever experiences?
Yeah, I mean, I can think of two examples, but I think what Des is talking about is right. Like it feels very different for me to be able to say that I code switch because it's not something that the risk is so much lower, right? You have to be aware that there's even a need. And if you're in the dominant culture, which I pretty much think I fit, white, cis, old dude, you're not often presented with a situation where you feel a need to have to assimilate to someone else. The world is assimilated to me. So just that mindset makes it harder to even think about it. But there's two examples, one very recent that Stephanie's gonna be familiar with, another one that's from ways back. I had to give, both of them were speaking, and I had to give a presentation in Texas to a leadership group of a large health system. And at the time, this was talking about Joe Public Doesn't Care and talking about the impact of the ACA, which came out in 2010, which by that point, this is like 2015, 16, 17, something like that, was pretty much known as Obamacare. And so in my spiel, I talked a lot about the impact of Obamacare or not. And I used the word Obamacare because most everybody in the industry just says that because it was natural. Sometimes pejoratively, as we well know. But when I raised that with my contact, she said, oh, no, you can't use the word Obama. And I'm like, what do you mean? It's like, you cannot use the word Obama with this group because there will be people that instantly tune you out because they hate the man, Barack Obama, so much that they will, you'll be a lib from the north and they will not listen to what you have to say. I was like, whoa, really? Like, we can't just have this conversation? Like, is that political? Yes. So I didn't use it because I'm like, all right, well, I want these folks to listen to me. Another example is a recent speaking engagement where we were talking about the new book, Joe Public 2030, and we were talking about this very topic, the rise of health sex. And we were talking about how that applies to a lot of the issues that we, you know, talk about today, one of which is women's reproductive rights or abortion. Group I was talking to was faith-based. And I'm like, okay, if I start throwing around even women's reproductive rights, these folks are going to start getting prickly. And if I certainly say abortion, I could lose a lot of this audience. So there's plenty of other ways to make the example of the rise of health sex. And so I avoided that one so that I wouldn't lose the audience. That's my two examples. Yeah. But it still feels not the same. Like, I feel like, Des, if you have to do it, like you said, there's an element of safety. I feel like I have more choice in the matter. Is that fair?
In some instances, it's gotten a lot better. I would say in the earlier part of the, almost said 19th century, but let's say before the civil rights movement, you know, there was a certain vernacular that a black person would need to put on when engaging with like white people, where it's almost like this performance, you know, and we don't have to do that necessarily anymore. And like I said, things have gotten better, but there's still steps that need to be taken. And that essentially, yeah, a person should be able to come in as their whole selves, you know, speak their own language, feel just comfortable existing in their own skin without having to worry. But no, it's still the case, especially when you think about the politicalization of movements like the Black Lives Matter, you know, existing while Black, there are things that we have to physically do to adjust for our own safety beyond code switching and how we speak. Like there's a, you know, like you can't wear certain clothes for fear of, you know, being seen as a threat. But there is a tinge bit of safety that comes up within your space, politicalization, because there is more violence that's uprising along that movement. So if you are in a less safe space, when you're talking about, like when you mentioned ACA versus Obamacare, then there could be something physical that would have happened to you. Like just hearing the stories of like Trump rallies in the past. So it depends, but yes, it's not as, you know, say as a safety issue as it would be for folks of color, queer folks, and otherwise various religions. But because there is such a, so many sects that are being built that it becoming further and further polarized from one another. And if you're not with me, then you're absolutely against me.
Interesting.
Your example?
I do have an example. And again, mine, you know, being a white woman, I've never felt like I need a, you know, safety or like I've been truly oppressed, but I do have an example. So I grew up in East Tennessee and was actually, my parents kind of lived in the rural area kind of when I was born. And so I went to my first years of daycare and preschool and got this intense Southern accent, Like videos of me as a 3-year-old is just ridiculous and wild. Like you're like, who is that little girl? So my mom, being from the Midwest, was like, this is not okay. We're not having this. She drilled into me, you know, you've got to have the radio voice. The radio voice is having no accent as much as possible. You want to have no accent. And she was from Iowa. And so they actually moved to a city inside of East Tennessee, Oak Ridge, that has a lot of transplants and people that are not from there, people from the North and other countries. Part of it, most of it, was to get better at education. But I have to say, I think part of it was, let's drill the Southern accent out of this little girl. So now, today, you know, luckily I've always lived and worked in the South, so it hasn't been an issue. But there are times when people say, oh, you're Southern. And I will like go home and work on it. But now that I live in Nashville, you know, it's okay to drop a y'all every once in a while. And in fact, like now I kind of try to do that. So, you know, I think that's the prejudice against the Appalachian.
Yeah, accent. You should speak to why your mom even considered that a bad thing.
Yeah,
right?
Fair. Like, mm-hmm.
Because especially in business.
Right, because it's stereotyped as if you have a Southern accent, you are less intelligent, you're less educated, and therefore less professional and all the things. So she, I guess, you know, wanted to make sure that I did not come across that way.
Yeah. Yeah. We've run into that at Revive. We've gotten feedback from folks like secondhand of having a team roll into New York or something. And people are like, you know, they don't think of it as a positive thing when they hear that twang.
Yeah.
It's kind of amazing, but true.
Our patron saint, Dolly Parton, and her, like my favorite subject. In yes. The podcast, Dolly Parton's America, they did a whole episode that was talking about students at University of Tennessee, Knoxville, and talking about their experiences of essentially having to drop their accents in order to, quote unquote, fit in or to. And it's not even about making people comfortable. It's more about like proving themselves that they're worthy of being here, being a part of this, you know, world. That's what it all kind of boils down to, is like essentially trying to prove to someone else, and they're based on their own values or beliefs, that you have value and you have something to give to the world. And that's honestly a shame, but I mean, media feeds this, our own lived experiences and what we tell people and what we harp on to our kids, like it's like spirals.
So and this goes beyond, I mean, we've been talking a lot about words and euphemisms, like we can't say gun control, we have to say gun safety, or we can't say Obamacare, we have to say ACA, or we can't say racism because we might offend some white people. But this goes far beyond the words. This goes to what we talked about, even your accent and the language you use. It goes to your mannerisms. It goes to the clothes you wear. Correct me if I'm wrong, Des. It goes to how you wear your hair. I mean, don't a lot of black people, especially black women, have to think twice about that?
We certainly do.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's all part of this, it feels like.
Mm-hmm. And even like taking it also a further step back into healthcare with the patient experience in nursing, like we've heard stories of round nurses have to, based on who the patient, whose room they're walking into, has to adjust to make sure that they don't incite any kind of response from that patient, you know, and that especially if you are a nurse of color, you know, go into a room, especially if you're in a certain area of the country, if you walk into the room, like you kind of have to almost like brace yourself. And I have found myself doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Where I remember I was on campus, this was a few years ago, I was having lunch with a friend of mine that was a professor. And we were just talking, and I could just kind of feel from the corner of my eye, this middle-aged white man, I think he had a plaid shirt on, and my mind automatically went to, because this was the height of the Trump era, I started to like fight or flight, you know? I was like, ooh, I just started to tense up, and nothing had even happened. And as he approached our table, we both just kind of slowly went, hi, hello. And he had recognized me from like a show, and he just was like, hey, I love your show. Thank you so much for what you do. And I was like, wow, I'm a jerk for just assuming, based on like what this guy looked like, or what, you know, I assumed myself about this gentleman, that it was going to be a negative experience. And so it is this like give and take. And like we were saying about like racism and the health lead, the health chief health person.
Chief health policy officer, somebody.
That.
Chief moron.
In the sense that he was like, oh, well, you know, if you say the term racist or racism, then you're automatically blaming Black people. But it's like, you know, we all have some sort of bias. And the more that we recognize it and try to, you know, adjust accordingly so that we aren't just automatically assuming the worst of others, the better. So not that I'm saying that I'm racist or anything, but like in that moment, I was like, wow, let me reflect on and not just automatically assume something about a person just based on their appearance.
You brought up the healthcare experience. And I'll just give this. I don't think this is a HIPAA violation. My dad, what's the euphemism for boomers that are
okay, boomer?
No, they're of a different time. My dad's of a different time. I'll just leave it at that. But a very innocuous example of how a healthcare professional had to code switch. We were there for Father's Day, and his nurse was there, and he's a great guy. We've seen him a number of times. And somebody said something to him. His name's Brian. And my dad's like, he's a really good nurse for a male nurse. And we were like, you mean just as a nurse, right? And he's like, well, no, for a male nurse. And the male nurse was like, huh? And he made a joke. So instead of like trying to argue or like, hey, look, there's no difference or whatever he could have said, he code switched to make a joke about like, yeah, the only time you know the difference is between strippers and nurses. Like he had it already planned. He already knew because he's probably dealt with it multiple times. But that to me is an example of code switching, because way easier for him to deal with somebody like my dad and just roll on than try to fight that or show up in a way that says like, no, actually, you know, blah, 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 whatever. So just a really innocuous example of how this impacts healthcare.
It is fascinating. I found myself doing that, having spent a lot of time in small southern towns where I have just kind of given into that vernacular. And I don't know, you going back to the language, I know you had mentioned that there was a bit from George Carlin that was really interesting around just how the language.
I mean, George Carlin's my favorite comedian of all time. You guys be familiar?
I'm not.
Stephanie, for
I know, I have so
sake.
Much homework. It's racking up.
Luke, George Carlin. Okay, you guys need to go just. There's a special, where is it, HBO?
It's on Hulu.
Hulu's got like a documentary on him, which will give you enough to go, I need to listen to everything this guy said. And some of the stuff doesn't hold up well, but most of it does. And so he goes through a thing, and I think it's kind of code switching, about how we continue to have to change our euphemisms, right? We can't talk about gun violence, so we have to talk about gun safety. And at some point, we're not even going to talk about gun safety. We're going to talk about mental health safety, and then it's just going to be human safety. So he talks about the condition that soldiers have where they've been in war and it really screws with their head and their nervous system just breaks down and they can't cope. So initially this was called shell shock, which is perfect, right? You're out in a foxhole, there's bombs blowing up and that drives you to the edge, which is totally understandable. Then he said in World War II, it changed to battle fatigue. It's like, okay, now it's longer, a little softer, like it's not shock, it's fatigue. Right? Mm-hmm. We have to have a euphemism. And then he says it went to operational exhaustion, which I've never heard of that, but that takes it completely out of the individual human realm. That sounds like, he says in his bit, that sounds like something that happens to your car. And then finally, of course, we're left with post-traumatic stress disorder. It's like we have four words, we get a hyphen, nobody knows what this means. Like it's so far removed from the actual human thing that we're talking about. And he's like, we just can't face the truth. That's his whole point, is like, we as humans have a really hard time facing the truth. So we're not gonna call it shell shock because that's too scary. We're gonna end up with post-traumatic stress disorder. And I just think that's exactly right.
Yeah, and knowing that we, from a communication standpoint, you know, dealing with that when we're trying to get out vaccine messaging, you know, it's like, how do you, say this in a way that's going to almost convince a person of like what, you know, isn't what you feel they need to do. So coming up with those languages of, you know, vaccine hesitancy versus, you know, a person that might be just anti-vaccine, you know, there's no moving them on, you know, their beliefs. But we still try to talk about it from a standpoint of like, oh, like we can still, you know, talk with and communicate with those that are vaccine hesitant. It's like, well, to what end? But yeah. You know, language is interesting.
It is, and it's giving me all these thoughts. I mean, first of all, language is a really important piece of culture, right? And ultimately what we're talking about at the larger level is culture, and whether it's language or appearance or mannerisms, those are all a significant part of culture. And so, I mean, we have many, many, many cultures that, you know, as brands or especially health brands that we have to consider. And it's making me think about, you know, the importance of speaking to people in their own language, but also the ability of targeting that allows you to do that. And in what cases do you try to send out a mass message, which if you do that on a topic like vaccines, you're going to end up speaking to the majority. The mainstream white majority, probably, right? Versus what if you really thought through what are all the cultures and considerations that we need to include here, and how can we be more targeted in our messaging?
Making that person feel seen and yes. heard and reflected in that messaging, in that, that ad, so that they feel like, wow, actually this is an organization that knows me, knows my experience. Right. This is where I want to get my healthcare from.
Yeah, I guess the downside of that is then you add to the echo chamber problem. But what I'm thinking is, and again, I'm thinking about vaccine messaging specifically, you brought it up, and I'm thinking about in social, and anytime you put out a vaccine message in social, you end up with this long list of very upset, angry comments, no matter what side of the debate you're on. If you were to, be more targeted, maybe you would end up with groups of people that are more in agreement with each other, but then you create echo chambers. So it's an interesting, maybe ethical
topic. It is. It's a dilemma, because if we can't be frank about and honest and truthful about some of these things, we're never going to get through. If we can't use the word gun violence, I mean, we're screwed. Like, I don't know, what are we supposed to say? Violence that occurs that it does not entail knives, clubs, or other implements. Like, it is gun violence. We're not even talking about why there's gun violence. Like, that could be political, and I can understand different viewpoints on why. But you can look at the statistics and see there's an increased level of gun violence in this country versus others, per human, per capita. That's not debatable. So we can argue about why or if we should do anything about it. But if we can't even agree to use the word gun violence to describe what's happening, we're done. And we are done. I think we should end on that positive note.
There you go. And scene.
All right. So let's wrap. Stephanie, Dez, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Always a pleasure.
Luke, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you all for joining us. Please leave us reviews, ratings on iTunes. It's helpful. If you want us to cover something, shoot us an email at nonormal@reviveagency.com. We would love to hear from you. We know you're out there. We can see you're listening. We just want to hear from you. Tell us what you want to talk about. Otherwise, we will talk to you next week. Remember, don't be satisfied with the normal. Push the no normal. That's not a euphemism, is it? The no normal? A little bit?
I'll have to convince you on that.
Is that code switching for chaos?
Wow.
No, we're not saying push chaos. Push chaos. Talk to you next week.
3, 2, 1. Here we go.